The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. 1965, my baby, Temptations, attempts hit the charts with this on this day in 1965. And you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Michelle Alexander, who's an associate professor of law at Ohio State University. And you last heard her on this program talking about her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Yesterday in the New York Times, she had a really interesting op-ed called In Prison Reform, Money Trumps Civil Rights, or as I might subtitle it, Don't Be Fooled Into Smiling. So Michelle, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And I gave it that subtitle because this you started off this piece about all the conservative leaders and governors from Newt Gingrich to John Kasich and others who are talking about prison reform, but you see that being motivated by a very different thing than what motivated you to write that book.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there has been a chorus of support for prison downsizing in recent years from many of the same people who were among the fiercest proponents of the Get Tough movement and the war on drugs. Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker and now presidential candidate, you know, shocked many people. You know, earlier this year, I believe in January, when he wrote an essay for the Washington Post, you know, calling on conservative legislators to lead the way in addressing an issue that had long been considered off limits to reform, prisons. You know, Republican governors nationwide have been sounding a similar theme, calling for prison downsizing, releasing some nonviolent, especially minor drug offenders. And the reason for this sudden turnabout has absolutely nothing to do with the extraordinary human toll of mass incarceration, the devastation the war on drugs has caused to poor communities of color in particular, and the suffering of millions of people who have been cycling in and out of our prison system, branded criminals and felons, and stripped of basic civil and human rights, including the right to vote. No, this, you know, has not been motivated by concern about them at all. It's all about their efforts to balance state budgets at a time of economic crisis and not wanting to raise taxes on the middle class, the white middle class. And so now that this massive prison state is beginning to cause them some problems, they say it's time to switch course, zig instead of zag, in order to make it easier for them to govern. But I argue, you know, at the end of that piece in the New York Times that we should be very wary about thinking that this, you know, sudden turnabout is going to result in the end of mass incarceration in its entirety. We will see some prison downsizing in the months and years to come, but we won't get back to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement kicked off without a major social movement. If, you know, we were to go back to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today, 4 out of 5.
That's pretty shocking when you wrote that. 4 out of 5 people have to be freed from prison if we were to go back to the incarceration rate of the 1970s.
That's exactly right. And, you know, not only would those folks have to be released from prison, but 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Private prison companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange would be forced to watch their profits vanish. Most new prison construction has occurred in predominantly white rural communities, communities that have been sold on prisons as the answer to their economic woes. And, you know, very often prisons have been advertised as providing far more benefits to these communities than they actually provide, as Ruthie Gilmore's research has documented so well. But nonetheless, these communities now believe, rightly or wrongly, that their economies and their jobs depend on prisons. And so enormous resistance will arise to the closing of prisons across the United States. So there will be some downsizing, but the same political interests that birthed Jim Crow, this new Jim Crow, you know, are not likely to dismantle it in its entirety without a major social movement, a drastic shift in public consciousness, and a demand from the bottom.
And you quoted a headline, NAACP joins with Gingrich in urging prison reform.
Yes.
Now, the subtext of that for me was you took particular umbrage at that headline.
Yes. Well, you know, I thought it was ironic at best that, you know, the Associated Press would run an article with that headline. The NAACP joins Newt Gingrich in calling for prison reform rather than the other way around. You know, there's this notion that now, you know, the NAACP is jumping on a movement launched by Newt Gingrich, when in fact, you know, civil rights organizations have been calling for an end to the racially biased drug war for a long time. You know, now momentum exists for reform, but that momentum has not, you know, been motivated out of concern for the people who are suffering in this system. Instead, it's been, you know, generated by the concerns of the very people who birthed the system in the first place, the desire to maintain their political and economic power now during a time of economic crisis. We can no longer afford this massive prison state, so it's become inconvenient. But, you know, these same interests that birthed the system are not likely to dismantle it in its entirety because, you know, as I mentioned, it's now so deeply entrenched in our political, economic, and social structures that it can't be dismantled in its entirety without a major movement, a grassroots uprising against the system. Otherwise, private prison companies will continue to lobby for harsh sentencing that will ensure that they get a good return on their investments. And as we've seen in states like California, where, you know, former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger publicly lamented the fact that the state was spending more money on prison uniforms and caps and gowns, more money on prisons than on education. His solution, after openly condemning that spending ratio, was to begin privatizing more prisons as a way of saving money. So, you know, their interests here, you know, these conservative legislators who are now calling for prison reform, their interests are not truly aligned with the interests of poor folks of color in this moment. It may appear as though they are, but they would be just as happy to save money by, you know, warehousing people in private prisons rather than releasing them or providing drug treatment or transferring the money away from incarceration and towards education.
You start the article off by quoting the great legal scholar Derrick Bell, who said that nothing will change in this regard, that the racial control that changed will continue to exist of this mass incarceration until it serves the interests of the white elites to change it. Now, talk about what that means analytically. What does that mean?
Well, you know, back in the late 1970s, Derrick Bell published an article, actually a couple of them, articulating what has come to be known as the interest convergence theory. He argued that systems of racial control, such as slavery and Jim Crow, last as long as they serve the perceived interests of white elites. Not a moment longer, not a moment less. And he applied his theory initially to the Brown versus Board of Education decision, and argued that the turnabout by the U.S. Supreme Court in Brown versus Board could be best explained by the criticism the United States was experiencing internationally over the Jim Crow system. Here you had, you know, black World War II veterans returning from risking their lives abroad fighting Nazism only to be returned to the Jim Crow South, where some of them were found hanging from trees. You know, news that, you know, sparked considerable outrage internationally as it highlighted the hypocrisy of Americans fighting bigotry abroad but denying African Americans full citizenship at home. And then, of course, to make matters worse, for the United States, you know, international communism was making inroads in third world countries, and there was considerable fear that communism would spread, you know, this is in the midst of the Cold War, would spread amongst African Americans frustrated by the persistence of Jim Crow in the South. And so he argued that, you know, the turn, the, you know, about face that the U.S. Supreme Court made in the Brown versus Board decision could be explained as much by, you know, concern about the regard of the United States internationally as it could by, you know, any, you know, legal reasoning or, you know, the capacity of persuasion of the civil rights lawyers who were crusading against the Jim Crow system. And he, Derrick Bell, received a tremendous amount of criticism when he published that article. But historians have since proved him correct. They actually, there's a wonderful book called Cold War Civil Rights that documents how the Justice Department intervened on the side of the NAACP for the first time in a desegregation case in response to cables from the State Department expressing concern about, you know, the spread of communism in third world countries, that there was, in fact, a direct link.
Now, when you quote Martin Luther King in this, let me just read a piece of what you wrote here. Because I was thinking about that in terms of what you wrote about Derrick Bell and the white elite. And that not changing until it affects them in their pocketbook or some way that will force them to move. You quote King in his letter from the Birmingham jail that he wrote in 1963, and he says, "I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the White Citizens Council or the Ku Klux Klan, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, and here's the key, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice." This other quote you have to tag along to it: "We will have to repent in this generation not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people." Now, fast forward that to 2011, where we sit now, and I wonder if you see things changing at all from that analysis of that moment in the midst of fighting segregation, when you have a minority of white Americans, but a large minority of white Americans, 43%, who voted for Barack Obama. And within that large minority, there is some huge portion that may agree with what you're writing. Do you know what I'm saying? So,
mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you see things analytically different, if you see things changing, and what the juxtaposition is for you.
Well, I think things have changed, but not as much as people would like to believe. As I note in the article, there's many people even within the civil rights community who believe now that it's futile to make arguments about racial inequality or to highlight the history of racial discrimination in our advocacy, because there's a consensus among mainstream Americans that we're beyond all that, that we've entered into an era of post-racialism. And so, you know, raising issues of racial inequality are sure loser, and we ought to just kind of ride this wave now that there's some momentum, political momentum generated for prison reform. We must just ride this wave and not raise issues of racial inequality because, to put it bluntly, you know, white folks don't want to hear about that. You know, what, you know, I contend is that, you know, mainstream whites have never wanted to hear about racial inequality or racial injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you had tested the messages that Martin Luther King was using, you know, in his letter from the Birmingham jail, which you just quoted, or much of, you know, the other language that he used, if you had tried to test those messages in a focus group in Alabama during the height of Jim Crow, you know, the messages would have failed. People would say, we don't believe it, we don't agree with it, we don't want to hear about it. You know, talking that way is likely to lead nowhere. In fact, even many African Americans in the early days of the Civil Rights Movement strongly resisted, King's language and rhetoric, saying that it was likely to prove counterproductive and make things worse rather than better in the South. And so there is a tendency, I think, today to believe that, you know, we are beyond the old days of caste-like systems, and that racial inequality, severe racial inequality and injustice, is part of our history rather than our present. And there is a temptation to want to kind of coddle the reluctance of white folks and people of other colors as well to hear about racial inequality and racial injustice. But I'm so grateful that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. and many of the other civil rights advocates of the time were not so easily deterred and were willing to force America to confront racial reality and to deal with it openly and honestly, in a way that was truly courageous. And I hope that we will see much more courageous, bold, open, and honest advocacy in the months and years to come, because the reality is that this drug war and this system of mass incarceration has not been driven by crime rates, is not reflective of differential patterns of drug use or sales and the black and brown communities as compared to whites, the extraordinary explosion in our prison system, and the severity of the racial disparities that we see have far more to do with racial politics and an indifference to the suffering of poor people of color than anything to do with crime or crime rates, as I describe in the book.
So if as you said in the article, and you and of course obviously in your book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, this new enslavement of people of color by our prison system. But as you wrote in the article and in the book, we'd have to release 4 out of 5 people that are behind bars now. We'd have to have 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Private prison companies will go belly up. And so when you call for dismantling this structure that we've built, I mean, there are movements in the ground all over the country that are saying no money for jails, put money in schools. It's happening in Baltimore, it's happening in D.C., Pittsburgh, Denver, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
So the question is, but it can't be a black-only movement, A.
Oh, absolutely not.
Right. So talk about what you see happening that can actually dismantle this prison complex we've built.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find fascinating and somewhat discouraging is that many people who believe in, as I do, that we need to build an interracial, interethnic movement for human rights and for justice for all, believe that the only way to build an interracial movement is to downplay or not talk about issues of race, to gloss over racial differences, racial inequality, because if you talk about race or racial inequality or group differences, then the cohesion, the between and among groups begins to unravel. And I think that's a false belief and a dangerous one, because as long as racial inequality and severe, you know, interracial, intergroup, interethnic differences persist, those differences and those inequalities are what present the greatest threat to long-term coalition building in politics. Not talking about the differences or acknowledging the differences, but the persistence of the inequality itself. And I think, you know, Dr. King himself demonstrated that it's possible to be a fierce critic of racial inequality and racial injustice, while at the same time demonstrating a commitment to fairness and justice for all. And at the end of his life, he was in the process of building a poor people's movement, a movement on behalf of poor people of all colors, and he was actively engaging poor and working class whites as well as Puerto Ricans and Native Americans and building an interracial movement on behalf of poor people of all colors. But he never got squeamish about addressing the reality of our history of racial caste in the United States or acknowledging the differences that exist between groups. So as we build a movement for schools, not jails, education, not incarceration, for jobs, not jail cells, we've got to do so with, you know, the goal of including all people and with a commitment to including all, but never by ignoring, denying, or sidestepping the severe racial inequalities that continue to persist.
As someone who was an organizer for the Poor People's Campaign in 1968, I couldn't agree with you more. So, Michelle Alexander, who has written the book The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration and the Age of Colorblindness, an assistant professor of law at Ohio State University. We're talking about the op-ed that she wrote in yesterday's New York Times, In Prison Reform, Money, Trump's Civil Rights. And Michelle Alexander, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have you on the air with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging media. Our producers are Mark Dunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Weird Al Yankovic, Eat It. He was born this day in 1959. Happy birthday, Weird Al.